So, again, I'm Dixie Noonan. This is my colleague, Kim Schaefer. We have Gary Cohen on the line from Washington. He's our general counsel. And we're with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. I'm sure that your counsel has told you a little bit about us. The commission is actually a bipartisan commission that was established by Congress in May of last year to examine the causes of the financial crisis. And we are in doing our investigation and are required by statute to give our report to Congress by December of this year. So we are doing our best. And one of the reasons that we wanted to talk to you is because the statute tells us specifically to look at the role that complex financial derivatives played in the crisis, and have learned a little bit about some of what you've done at Deutsche Bank through Michael Lewis's book, among other things. And so want to talk to you about that. But I would appreciate if you could just start by giving us sort of an education and professional background.
Sure. I graduated college in 1991 from the University of Pennsylvania. Started working at Credit Suisse First Boston in November of 91, and joined Deutsche Bank in March of 2000. And I currently am the head of ABS, the secondary trading of asset-backs and CDOs.
What did you do at CSFB?
I traded subordinated mortgage and asset-backed securities, and the last year also CDOs.
And then when you started at Deutsche Bank in 2000, what did you do when you started there?
I traded subordinated asset-backs and subordinated mortgage-backed securities.
Dixie, it's Gary. Could you move the speaker closer to the microphone, rather?
It's sort of built in, Gary. It's Walter, but we'll ask Greg to speak up a little bit. So
I'm looking. Yeah. At Ms. Nunes. Should I be looking over there?
I actually think here's there's a mic right. Okay. Maybe I had it covered up a little bit. Yeah. Yeah.
Is that better?
That's better. Whoever said that.
I think it was that the paper was on top of the speaker.
Of the mic. Yeah. No. So sorry about that. So I'm sorry. Tell me again. You started at Deutsche Bank in 2000, trading subordinated asset-backed securities, mortgage asset-backed securities.
Right. That's correct.
And what was your title, I guess?
Director.
You started as a director, and then did that change?
I was promoted to managing director in 2002, but my role hadn't really changed very much other than just my title changed. And sometime, I took over the trading of CDOs sometime between 2002 and 2003, I don't recall.
So that's all CDO trading?
Yes.
And so what types of CDOs would that have involved?
It's the secondary trading of CDOs, so I was not involved in the creation of new CDOs or the marketing of them, but rather to the extent that institutional customers wanted to buy or sell CDOs in the secondary market, they would approach me and my team and say, you know, we bought this CDO perhaps from Deutsche Bank, perhaps from another bank, but we'd like to sell this specific CDO investment. Where would you price that, or where would you make markets in that CDO for us? At the time, most of the CDO trading was in high-yield bond and loan-backed CDOs, with some modest trading in asset-backed CDOs and emerging market CDOs back then.
And then how did the CDO trading business sort of evolve over time? When did you start to see more asset-backed CDOs?
The ABS CDO origination business began to grow in 04 and 05 and really grew very rapidly in 06 and 07. But the issuance of CDOs isn't always consistent with the trading of them, because a lot of the people that bought CDOs at new issue buy them as a buy and hold investment. So whereas ABS CDO issuance increased exponentially, the trading of ABS CDOs increased more modestly in the beginning.
And so when would you have seen more trading then?
Probably 07 and 08. ABS CDO trading was never that big of a business doing related basically to how quickly the, from when they were created to when they sort of started to perform very poorly. It was a very short window of time.
So if we could maybe focus specifically, and do we still have copies of these?
We do.
Flip books. Maybe I could just... You are much more familiar with these than I am. I'm 100% certain of that. But these are just a couple that, that I've looked through and wanted to talk with you about. And so before we talk specifically about the presentations, could you tell us a little bit about, I understand that you started sort of doing this in 2005, is that right? Thinking about the shorting home equity mezzanine tranches transactions?
Yeah, I think that I started to be short late in 2005, somewhere October, November kind of area. I don't remember exactly.
So what was the genesis of the idea to go short in this market?
Sure. The development of the CDS contracts created for the first time, really, in my career, the ability to be either long or short. So whereas for the first 10 plus years of my trading, there was no way to be short. You could be really long or less long, but you could only be long. And then when these CDS contracts were created, since you could be short, I thought that it would be an interesting intellectual exercise to examine the securities in more detail than I ever had before, and that I think than most people in the business ever had before. So what I was aware of about the securities is that given the nature of the loans, most of the loans being what's called 228 loans, fixed at a low rate of interest for 2 years and then stepping up to LIBOR plus 600 basis points after that, it seemed likely that the loans would be refinanced shortly after that two-year period to the extent that they could be, and to the extent that they couldn't be refinanced, some people might default. So when I looked at when I looked at it from that perspective, I felt that the duration of the investment, whether you were long or short, it would be relatively short, meaning that in 2 to 4 years, the trade would pay off in full or would not pay off in full, in terms of investors would get back par if they had bought these securities. When I looked, with Eugene's help, when I looked at the home prices to defaults across America, I was struck by two things. You know, one, the big difference between the default rate in the parts of the United States where home prices were going up 3 or 4% per annum, and the much, much lower default rate in places where home prices were going up more like 12 or 13% per annum. I was also surprised at how many people were defaulting even in those areas where home prices were going up so much, which made me question the viability of these loans in a more modest home price environment. So when I looked at the duration of the investment being relatively short, 2 to 4 years, based on when the loans would be refinanced, and the possibility that if home prices began to moderate in some of the high home price performing states, it seemed that when you overlay that with how small the tranches were, these triple B tranches tended to be about 1% of the capital structure of a securitization, it seemed that to the extent that home prices went up 3 or 4% per annum in some of the previously very robust housing markets, there was a distinct possibility that these securities, these triple B securities, would receive little to no principal. So in doing the math, so that if you were to buy these securities, if you were to go long them, you would receive about 2 percentage points over LIBOR interest for 2 to 4 years. So you would make, as an investor, you would make, I guess that's, you know, 2% a year for 2 years would be 4 points, and 2% a year for 4 years would be 8 points. You would make 4 to 8 points if the investment were to work out. Or said another way, if home prices were to continue to go up 12% per year in California and some of the other states that had experienced robust housing, if home prices were to do that, were to keep going up, you'd make 4 to 8 points. On the other hand, if home prices were to moderate, since these tranches were very thin, the possibility of you losing 50 or even 100 cents on the dollar was very real. So,
just to be clear, these are residential mortgage-backed security tranches.
Yeah, to be clear, these are subprime residential mortgage-backed securities. They weren't prime or Alt-A or option ARMs. We were focused in the beginning entirely on subprime mortgage securities only. And also, since we talked briefly about CDOs, I want to be clear that this is not about CDOs. This is about subprime, predominantly triple B and triple B minus securities. So in looking at the investment thesis, the long side of this trade pays 4 to 8 points if it's correct, and it loses 50 to 90 points if it's incorrect. The inverse is the case to the extent that one was short. If one bought CDS protection, you would make 50 to 80 or 90 points to the extent that home prices, in my thesis, home prices flattened out, and you would lose 4 to 8 points if home prices did not flatten out. So the payout was somewhere on the neighborhood of, you know, 10 or even more than 10 to 1. And my own view was that at some point, home prices couldn't continue to go up at 12% per annum. The affordability was getting more and more difficult. So this investment, buying protection, shorting home equity mezzanine tranches, as the title of this presentation says, shorting was paying somewhere between no less, depending on your view of how what the default rates would be and the timing, it was paying somewhere between 6 and 20 to 1. Or said in other ways, the investment thesis was, if you believe that there's at least a 30% chance that home prices will start to moderate in some of these previously high home price appreciation states, if you thought there was at least a 30% chance of that occurring, this was an investment with a fantastic payout. And so I went to the management of Deutsche Bank and I gave them a synopsis similar to what we just discussed. And I said that I think that this makes sense because the payout far exceeds the loss when adjusted for the probabilities. I represented that I thought there was less than a 50% chance that this trade would actually work. But I felt that even if it's less than a 50% chance of working, if you're getting paid, you know, 5 or 10 or even more than 10 to 1, you don't need to actually think it will work for it to be sensible, particularly when the institution as a whole, specifically in these products and then more broadly, was an institution like most Wall Street firms that is biased towards investments doing well. That the Deutsche Bank, like all Wall Street firms, is positive carry, which means that we have far more investments that succeed if the markets rally than if the markets falter.
So was the when you went to Deutsche Bank management, first of all, who did you go to?
Richard Dalbert and Rajiv Misra.
Richard Dalbert and who?
And Rajiv Misra.
How do you spell his last name?
M-I-S-R-A.
Was your suggestion for Deutsche Bank to take this position, or was it for Deutsche Bank to sell this position?
It was for Deutsche Bank to take this position.
And would you mind going back just a minute? I missed some of the numbers. I think you said 6 and 1 to 20, or I missed that.
Sure. Well, roughly speaking, the securities were trading at 200 basis points over LIBOR. So it would mean that if you were to buy protection, you'd be paying 2% per annum as long as the securities were around. When they paid off in full, if they paid off in full, the trade would end. So your loss would be that 2% for as many years as it took. Alternatively, to the extent that the investments that the defaults on the underlying mortgages were sufficient to cause losses to these tranches, you would be paid. You would make however percentage of the tranche didn't pay back. So people had different theories about, first of all, how long it would take. So how many years would you be losing the 2%? Would it be 2 years, 3 years, or more than that? And on the other hand, how much of the tranche would be recovered in a default scenario? So would you be making, not counting the insurance premiums that you've been paying, would you be making 50 cents, 60 cents, 90 cents, what have you? So when you look at the payout of it, it's not like a very clear answer. It is X. The payout is somewhere between 4 and 10, sort of the insurance premiums that you're paying, and the profits that would accrue to you to the extent there were defaults would be somewhere between 30 and 90, roughly, depending on, as it turned out, home prices didn't merely moderate, which was what we were investing in that thesis, but rather they went down a lot, and the recovery of these securities was closer to 0 cents. had we had the view that home prices would collapse, there would have been payouts that we could have done where we would have lost two, you know, we would have lost like less than one and made 80. So we weren't actually predicting that home prices would collapse. Had we had, we would have done something very different. We were predicting.
Would that have meant in shorting sort of a higher rated tranche? Is that how you would have done
that? That's right. So for example, the double A tranches, which are now in many cases in jeopardy of recovering 0 cents, were trading at 10 or 20 basis points. So to have shorted those for 4 years, you would have lost a half of 1 point and made the same as what our investment did, where we paid out. Now, let's just say it's been 4 years, so we've paid out 8 or 10 points to make what, if you had shorted the AA, you would have paid out a half of 1 point. So you would have paid out, so you could have, in theory, for the same amount of dollar amount of losses, you could have invested, you could have made 20 times as much money.
But it was a riskier bet because a lot more had to go wrong.
You had to believe that home prices were going to go down 20 or 30%, which was never something that we contemplated. We contemplated that home prices would moderate. And so the reason that we focused on the triple B tranches was because it was our belief that home prices up 4% per year, the triple B tranches would sustain losses.
How did you know about the CDS being available? You said that for 10 years, the first 10 years of your career, that this just wasn't available. I mean, how did you learn about this as a possibility?
Well, I believe that CDS were being done by a variety of banks in what's called a bespoke basis for many years, which means that there were individualized contracts being created between an investment bank and a client for a long time. But due to the lack of standardization, it was a very small market and one that we were never involved with. You know, there's difficulty in doing non-standard contracts in terms of the fungibility of them. But as the growth of derivatives in other markets continued exponentially, there became more and more talk about, well, if there are derivatives on corporates, why aren't there derivatives on these securities and whatnot? And again, there had been, but in a very small format. So we began to be asked by customers, would we make markets and derivatives on these securities? And in 05, we were asked by that by a variety of institutional customers. So we began to explore the possibility of it, and we heard that other firms were also exploring the possibility and doing trades. And we would be told by certain institutional customers, I've just done a trade with this broker-dealer or that broker-dealer, and this is the CDS contract that we agreed to with them. Would you trade with us on that contract? So we did some trades on contracts that had been created by a handful of different broker-dealers, and then felt it made sense to try to standardize it.
Were these institutional investors that came to you, were they wanting to take long positions in the derivative contracts, or were they both ways?
Both ways.
Sorry, there was an article on Bloomberg about a bunch of folks gathered, I forget whether you were included, honestly, over Chinese food to discuss standardizing this. There were other people from Goldman, from Bayer. Were you part of that group who collectively met to try to figure out how to standardize the CDS?
Yes, I was one of the people. I'm familiar with the article you're referring to, and I was one of the people that was involved in that. I believe, and I don't remember for sure, but I think that the original people was Deutsche Bank, Goldman Sachs, Bear Stearns, J.P. Morgan, and Citibank, but I'm not positive because it's a long time ago.
Around when?
This would have been the middle of 05.
And do you remember specific people?
Some, you know.
Who do you remember?
Who
being
do
there?
I remember? I mean, I don't always remember the names of the people, you know, because it's a long time ago. But to go firm by firm, from Bear Stearns, I remember Scott Eichel and Todd Cushman. Also, not everyone went to every meeting, so it's hard to remember who was at what meeting. Goldman, I remember. Fabrice Torre, I remember Jonathan Eagle, I remember Mike Swenson. From J.P. Morgan, I don't know how to spell it, a fellow, his name was Kano, was his first name. I don't remember his last name. And there was another guy there, but he was English or French, but I don't remember his name. From Citibank, I remember Matt Sherwin.
Matt Sherwin?
Sherwin. Yeah. I believe he works at J.P. Morgan now.
Thank you.
Did I hit all the firms?
Yes.
Okay.
Who convened
Sorry, Morgan Stanley?
They were not one of the original people.
Who sort of convened this working group, if you will?
No individual convened it. I think that what was happening was there were increasing interest for derivatives on asset backs from institutions. And so we would have, you know, whereas it had been one a month and then it had been one a week, and now it was three or four or five calls a day from different institutions saying, we're getting involved in this and we want more dealers to do this because we want there to be more liquidity. So we've already done trades with Goldman Sachs and Bear Stearns or whomever, and we'd like to do trades with you as well. So what would end up happening is it'd be a lot of time spent on the documents and a lot of time, and then you'd find that the document from one broker-dealer was almost entirely the same as a document from another broker-dealer, but not exactly the same. So I don't know whose idea originally it was to say, well, why don't we try to make them the same? I don't think it was any one person's. I think maybe in frustration you'd say, oh, well, our document and your document is so similar, we should try to make ours the same. And at the same time, that individual might have been talking to another broker and saying, hey, our document and your document is so similar, why don't we make them the same? And then that guy was, you know, or what have you, or that lady. So there wasn't, it's sort of like who invented the wheel. Like, a lot of people probably thought about it at the same time. I don't know that anybody's idea specifically was, well, let's all get together, because there was a lot of people getting together individually. But as was reported, you know, the first meetings were happened at Deutsche Bank, but I don't know that it makes any sense to say that it was our idea.
You had better Chinese.
Yeah, I think we were willing to pay for the food, so.
Who else from Deutsche Bank was there?
Again, I don't, you know, at the time it didn't seem as significant as it had become, but presumably the person who was the most senior who reported to me at the time, Hiroki Kurita, was probably there.
How do you spell?
I think he goes by Rocky, but so I'm not sure. Kurita is Kurita. And probably either David Santor or Matt Reba, who were our derivatives, like, document lawyer individuals. So one, I'm sure that one of them was there. I just don't remember which one.
And fast forward a little, it took about 6 months before you went from these industry meetings to having an approved standardized ISDA agreement? Is it longer? Or do you remember the
date? I don't remember, but that sounds about right, 6 months. Okay. I mean,
I apologize, I don't think I read this article. But was this something that was done through ISDA? Or was, I mean, all the dealers were presumably members of ISDA already? At what point did it become an ISDA agreement as opposed to?
I think that that it's towards the end of the process, a variety of other dealers sort of asked to be included, and that would have included, you know, at that time probably Morgan Stanley, Merrill Lynch, Credit Suisse, Bank of America, perhaps Lehman, and once sort of the various firms had sort of agreed on language, I think that at some point it was presented to ISDA as, this is language that we all support, you know, is it language that you would endorse? And I wouldn't have been involved in the presentation to ISDA, so I don't really remember the details.
And I, again, would the timing of this process have been in 2005?
Yes.
And so at some point, would it have been before you sort of went to management and proposed the idea of shorting the mezz tranches? Would it have been standardized by then, and would that have been the type of the form of the agreement that you used for your trades?
The attractiveness of being involved in it was related to the standardization, because it gave one a greater confidence of fungibility and liquidity that there was a standardized agreement. So I think that, and I don't remember the timeline exactly, but I'm sure that when I went to management, if it hadn't been agreed upon, it had been almost agreed upon. So it was sort of like, well, this is going to happen. This contract is going to be agreed upon. I mean, I think that actually, you know, when we first were involved in this, we were not short. Our first trades were actually to get long, you know. So when we first got started doing the trades, we didn't do this in order to be short. We decided to get short afterwards. So when we started working on the standardization, it was, you know, late in the first quarter or the second quarter of 2005. We don't decide to get short until October or November of 2005. It mainly because it didn't, unless there was a contract, the analysis that we did that made us feel that the payouts of the long versus the short were so skewed, it wasn't an analysis that it would make any sense to do because you couldn't be short before, so we didn't think about it. We didn't think first, oh, it would be great to be short, let's create these contracts. In the beginning, we thought it would be great to trade more securities because as a market maker, the more trades you do, the more money you would make if you can garner the bid-ask spread. So in the beginning, we thought it made sense to trade more things. Only later did we decide that it made sense to be short these.
Have you read Michael Lewis's book?
I read it once when it first came out.
I could be misremembering this, but I thought I read that it was someone at Deutsche Bank who came to you and asked you to start taking short positions. Is that right or no?
Well, I only read it once also, and I read it several months ago, so I've had a lot of things going on since then, you know. I'm not sure what you're at. There's two different things you might be asking about. You know, one would be that I think he referenced a period of time where the new issue CDO group put some pressure on me to be shorter than I wanted to be in order for them to do CDOs. Is that what you're referring to?
I think so.
So that's accurate.
But that wasn't at the beginning. That was later on?
No, that was in late 2005.
That was in late 2005. You'd already decided that you thought going short was a good idea, but then they put...
I thought being modestly short was a good idea. In order to complete some new issue CDO, I think that they nobody really wanted to short these securities in 2005. So doing a synthetic CDO was difficult if no one would provide the collateral for the CDO. So whereas with the benefit of hindsight, being short now seems like a very obvious thing to do. At the time, people thought it was crazy to be short these securities. And so I wanted to be short a certain amount of it, which I felt was sufficient in order for me to keep my job to the extent that I was wrong, which I thought was quite plausible I was. Again, I went to the bank and I didn't suggest that it was likely this trade would work. I rather suggested that the payout was far greater than the unlikelihood that it was, right? So I said, I think that there's a one-third chance that I'm correct, but I'm getting paid $6. So we should, if you were to always invest your money that way, most often you would lose, right? Because you would only have a profitable investment one out of every three times. But you would eventually become extremely wealthy because one out of every three times you would earn $6. And two out of every three times you would lose $1. So you would usually be a loser, but you would eventually become extremely wealthy. Right? So I went to the bank and I said, I think it's unlikely this works, but if it does work, it pays much more. So the bank was comfortable with a certain amount of cost to that. But the article that you refer to, Michael Lewis, certain people at Deutsche Bank wanted me to be shorter because it enabled them to garner more fees, and no one wanted to be short at the time.
And just to clarify, that was not your providing sort of warehousing, if you will, of shorts. It was you were having the short position and presumably for some time continuing to hold it.
Yes, my secondary trading desk would have to have provided the initial short into some CDO that the new issue group would create. And to the extent that we were never able to find someone else who was willing to short home equity mezzanine tranches, we would have had to have been short those for the duration of the investment.
When you started out doing this, who was selling the protection that you were buying to take your short position? I mean, who was taking the long?
CDOs and to some CDOs, some hedge funds, and some mutual funds, predominantly.
Mutual funds?
Mm-hmm.
Like which mutual funds?
I recall that Fidelity had a fund in particular that they sold protection, and there were other mutual funds that had, but they were among the largest non-CDO sellers of protection.
So how did the process evolve from you taking a short position to marketing, shorting the home equity mezzanine tranches?
Sure. Sometime March or April or late February, I don't remember exactly, of 2006, the trade had gone against me in the sense that the price of these securities had risen further. So there was some pressure from management of Deutsche Bank that the trade wasn't really working and perhaps we should get out. And I had tried to remind them that when we first went with the thesis, we didn't suggest that it was going to work soon. You know, we suggested, in fact, that it probably would never work, but it would take 2 to 4 years to know for sure, and we would lose this 2% a year for every year, and then we'd find out. And their response was, well, we want to see that there's a certain amount of trading, right? So far, no one in the world seems to think this makes any sense, and no one is an exaggeration, but very few people, and obviously John Paulson, most notably, was one of the people who had a similar view to me at the time. But very few people have this view that buying protection on these tranches makes sense relative to the large number of people who thought selling protection made a tremendous amount of sense. So I think the bank questioned whether it was a sensible thing to do. So they wanted to see that I could have liquidity, that there wasn't just me and John Paulson and, as is reported by Michael Lewis, Dr. Michael Burry, but rather that there were other people. So sort of with that impetus is when we began in earnest to talk to people and to update this book every month and whatnot.
So, I think the first book that I have is January 06. There may have been some earlier slides, but do you remember starting to work on it in January 06?
I probably worked on it slightly earlier. I mean, I think that the initial look, if you will, may have even gone to Deutsche Bank management as like, here's why. I think that writing the book was helpful to me in terms of helping me crystallize my own thoughts. So perhaps the original recipient of this book was me. I wrote it to myself.
Okay. And just so I really want to understand, we can do maybe some of this now and maybe some of it later. But I'd really like to understand how the contracts worked. And so when you said that the trades were already going against you after being in them for a few months, how did you, were you marking these things?
You're speaking of price.
Yes.
The price of the underlying assets, the market price of the underlying assets.
Well, ultimately, people were making markets both in cash securities and in the CDSs that reference those cash securities. And there was what's called a basis, which is that to the extent that the cash market is trading at a higher or lower price than the CDS. But it was reasonably well known what the markets were of these securities. So we may have bought protection into at 200 basis points. So we were making the market at the time 200, 210, meaning we would buy protection from an investor at 200 basis points. We would be willing to pay them 200 per year, and we'd be willing to sell protection at 210 basis points. If someone else was willing to buy protection from us, they'd have to pay us 210 basis points a year. So it was reasonably transparent that now that it's the end of the first quarter of 2006, now the market is, I don't remember exactly, but roughly speaking, 175, 185, meaning that people now are willing to sell protection at 185 and buy protection at 175. So if we had bought protection at 200, one could estimate the price of our contract would be higher than par, right? Because now people are willing to sell protection at 185, but we have a contract where we're paying 200. So the price of the of our contract would be higher than par. So we took a certain amount of mark-to-market loss related to saying, well, today, the very same thing that in November we paid 200 basis points for, today we could do this exact same trade or similar, very similar trade at 185 basis points.
Did that have an effect on P&L? Is that the right way to say it?
Yes.
It did?
Absolutely.
Okay. Plus you couldn't go sell it for 210 if somebody else would sell it for 185, presumably.
Well, those are similar things, right? So you would have to say, since we marked our books to the best of our abilities, we marked to market every single day. We would acknowledge, well, now the market in this security is 175, 185. So our 200 contract, and you know, let's assume just for simplicity that we thought it had a four-year duration, which meant that it would pay off in full in 4 years, assuming nothing went awry. So for 4 years, I'm paying 200 basis points, and I could be paying 175, right? Because there are people today who would be happy to receive 175. So I'm paying 25 basis points too much, if you will. I'm paying more than I could for 4 years. So that's roughly call that one, you know, 25 times four is one, right? Mm-hmm. So you would say, well, if we did $100 of this trade, and I'm oversimplifying it a little bit, but it's broadly speaking what it is. If we did $100 of this trade in November, today we've lost, in addition to the interest that we have paid, we've lost one extra dollar, because if we went to the individual that we were paying 200 for and we said, look, we want out, they would say, well, I want in. And for me to stay in, someone else is going to do it with me at 175, because that's the market today. So if you want out, I want that 25 basis points that I would have been receiving from you for the next 4 years, I want that now. So if you give me $1, we'll forget about this whole thing. So we marked our book. We said, well, we did $100 of this trade. We've lost what we've paid in interest premiums. And in addition, we've lost $1 because that would be the cost to rip it up. Does that answer
mm-hmm.
the question?
Mm-hmm. And so, just so I'm clear, so that had an effect on how you marked your book on a daily basis, but it didn't necessarily impact the contract that you would have entered into. You would have reflected that on your books, but in terms of the contract, you're still going to pay the 200 basis points annualized every month, and you won't know for a couple of years if the actual economics of the transaction have worked out for you or not, unless you sell it sometime in the meantime.
It's a market loss rather than a realized loss.
That's accurate. So we would report, let's assume now that we actually didn't, let's pretend that you had sold me the protection at 200. We never speak again. I would put on our books and records, well, we've lost $1 because now the market for this is 175, 185, but I would continue to be paying you 200 basis points on an annualized basis every month. So the fact that I'm marking the trade 1 point against me has nothing to do with you. We don't exchange any monies. I mean, there may be margin calls back and forth.
Well, I was going to ask, were there any contractual provisions that would have, that mark-to-market would have had an impact on, collateral provisions or margin provisions?
Yeah, every contract has something that has language that relates to that. So either there's a targeted amount that the margin has to be paid. So in our example, if the contract is worth 105 or 95 cents, maybe nothing has to be exchanged between us. But if the contract is 106, you might say, well, give me a dollar because I'm afraid of you as a counterparty. You're never going to pay me this very high interest rate forever. Or vice versa, if the contract was trading at 94, I might say, well, it looks like you may owe me money someday, so I want at least $1 now. There were other contracts that maybe only monies were exchanged if one of the counterparties had been downgraded their credit rating. That's not something that I focused on. I ran the secondary trading of that. There were credit areas that negotiated credit agreements with different counterparties. That wouldn't be something that I knew a lot about. I didn't have the power to say this counterparty was a good credit or a bad credit. That was someone else's role, and I wouldn't negotiate those documents.
So, but even on the contracts that you would have entered into on the CDS buying protection, would someone else have taken over that part of the managing the agreements?
Yes.
And who would that have been?
I don't even know. I mean, there's a group in Deutsche Bank that is in charge of counterparty risk management. There's a derivatives documentation group. There's a variety of groups that it's not something that was transparent to me. My role was to make markets in the securities and not to focus on legal or counterparty risk. So I didn't.
It's just an interesting question. One of the things we're trying to figure out is what the standard provisions of these contracts were, because as I'm sure you know, there were some counterparties to credit default swap contracts who ended up getting into trouble not because the swaps experienced economic loss or realized loss, but because they had provisions that required them to post collateral upon decline in the market value of the underlying assets. And so trying to figure out whether that was standard is something that we're looking at.
I think, and again, it's not an area that I would have been, highly rated counterparties. So whereas most people, so a hedge fund would have had to post collateral as soon as there was a decline in value or an increase in value to the extent they were short, highly rated counterparties such as banks and insurance companies would only have to post collateral if they were downgraded. But
The book says that you called Michael Burry and asked him, is that right?
You know, I don't remember that. I mean, I guess I would say a few things. Michael Burry didn't convince me. Like, I don't agree that I stole his idea. I think that's absurd. It's not, you know, he may perceive it as such. He asked us to offer protection on some securities. We are asked by people every day to offer, you know, to buy, sell, to make markets in all the things that we trade. And if we spent time sort of evaluating the investment decisions of everybody that called us, we wouldn't do anything other than that. So he asked us to make markets at some point before the standardized contract came about. We made him markets on the contract that we were using at the time. We did some trades. I was told that our corporate CDS area, which was not an area that fell under me, was cutting him off because of some, you know, issues they had with him that had nothing to do with asset backs or what have you. So we disengaged with him because of trade problems he had with other parts of Deutsche Bank. We got out of all the trades we had with him. But at some point, perhaps, and I don't remember that because it wasn't momentous at the time, but we probably got to a point where we had a list of hedge funds that, because of these books, were happy to buy protection from us. So it wasn't so much that we were long, but we needed to find. So whereas what's curious about this market is, whereas in the end of 2005 through the middle of 2006, it was impossible to find anyone who wanted to buy protection. At some point, it becomes almost the reverse. So we may have called him up. I don't remember that. It wasn't important to me. I might have called him up, as I would have called up anyone who I knew that was short, and said, hey, if you want to get out, I know someone who wants to get in. So as a market maker, and we had one side of the market, we needed to find the other side, and I knew that he was someone, and I don't remember calling him, so I'm not even sure that I knew, but to the extent that that's true, to the extent that he told Michael Lewis that and he was telling the truth, I would have called him up, as I would have called up a lot of people, and said, if you want to get out of these contracts, I know somebody who wants to get in them.
When you read the book, was there anything, do you remember, that struck you as being inaccurate?
The book is, first and foremost, meant to entertain. So I think there are a lot of things that are exaggerated. So where do you draw the line between inaccurate and exaggerated? Is any individual draws that line on their own. I think the thing I have most problem with is the comment about idiots in Germany, because that's taken out of context. And I don't doubt that I was asked many times, if this is such a good idea, like, what are the people, like, why are all these institutions that are buying billions of dollars of CDOs, what are they missing that you understand? And if you're asked that question 20 times, and then somebody says to you, well, do you think it's smart or whatnot what they're doing? You might say, well, they're getting paid so little if they're right, and they're going to lose so much if they're wrong. It's sort of like saying, well, if I told you that you win if it's heads, if we flip a coin, and you win on heads and tails, but if it lands on its side, like something really, really, really bad happens to you, maybe you would play anyway, but maybe you would say, you know what, this doesn't sound like something that's interesting for me to be involved with. So my opinion about the people that were along this was, first of all, that they didn't understand that it wasn't actually only if it lands on its side, but that if home prices decline. But more importantly, that you're being paid a very small premium or you would lose a tremendous amount. So if someone said to me, well, do you think that that's an idiotic investment? I might have said, yeah. So I think that comment that where it's attributed to me that I said idiots in Germany buy this, I think it's taken way out of context. It's certainly not something that I led with. I didn't go into people and say, well, you should buy protection because idiots in Germany are selling protection. Like, that's not how it came about. So what I can remember from the book, that's the thing I have most problem with. I think in general it's exaggerated. I would be happy to clarify any specific things in the book that you have any questions about. Well, is this true or was this exaggerated or whatever? I'd be happy to respond to that. But I don't remember. The only thing I remember today, having read the book 3 months ago, was that comment.
Okay, thanks. And I'm sure that there will be a few other things as we go through, and it's helpful to ask, mostly to clarify that record. So I thank you for that. Wanted to talk to you a little bit about what you asked Eugene Hsu to analyze when you started thinking about this, and how you directed him and what he found and how that impacted your thinking.
Sure. The very first thing was the home prices against defaults. And that I looked at that
specifically data. In the subprime sector.
Yeah, we started.
And how did you define subprime? I'm sorry to interrupt, but
subprime, how was it defined? I think it's 600 to 680 FICO. I'm not even sure. I was a secondary trader. I never ran the loan origination group, and I was never in investment banking. I didn't understand these loans, and maybe that helped me, in a way that a lot of the people understood the loans, because they had been more intimately involved in underwriting guidelines and understanding underwriting guidelines of how these loans were made. I never did that. So subprime, if I remember correctly, is 600 to 680 FICO. That's a definition not of mine, but of the market.
It strikes me that the title of the flip book is Shorting Home Equity Mezzanine Tranches, and not shorting subprime mezzanine tranches. Was there a focus on home equity mortgages, or what was the reason for that?
That's just a semantical issue. Home equity is a catch-all for subprime and home equity liens, you know, which you may be more familiar with, where you have like a home equity line of credit if you want to paint your house or what have you. That's not what that's a tiny, tiny market, and we didn't really buy protection on that. Home equity was a term invented by somebody to describe subprime mortgages in like the early 90s. I have no idea who invented that term. That's just what people call subprime.
So pardon me for interrupting you. We were talking about Eugene Hsu and the analysis that you asked him to perform.
Sure. So in the beginning, I wanted to explore whether it made sense to buy protection or sell protection on these. So I attempted to figure out the viability of these investments across scenarios. So the very first thing I asked him to do was to sort America into quartiles based on home price appreciation and tell me the default rate in each of them. So that's what he did, and we also did the same thing for loss severity. So we looked at when people, so the first is the incidence of default, and the second is the magnitude of the default. So the first looked at how many people defaulted based on the home price appreciation in their neighborhood, and then it was when they default, how much is recovered, or how much is lost, the inverse of the recovery on that. So we that was enough for me to be confident that it made sense given the low cost of buying protection and the potential windfall of the investment in buying protection. That was enough for me. Most of the other charts only came about from various hedge funds and other investors that we talked to. As Michael Lewis reports, I spent some time trying to talk to AIG and other investors. So people would say, well, you're wrong because you didn't look at X or you didn't look at Y. So then I would have Eugene look at X or look at Y. And I found nothing that dissuaded me from the single most important factor was home prices.
The way that Michael Lewis tells the story as I recall it, about you meeting with AIG was apropos of you wanting to convince them to shut down the market because this would help the positions you already had. Is that?
I would say that I had two thoughts. The first was my trade wasn't working because AIG in particular was buying lots of these CDOs. I can say with all candor that I thought that if AIG had a lot of trouble, you know, as an American, it wouldn't be a good thing. But I would acknowledge that my primary motivation was to slow the growth of a market that I thought was out of control. But I thought about helping them and not just helping myself as well, for sure.
So this is, I mean, it's a story about really calling the market right, right?
And excuse me.
Yes.
So, but you weren't, did you, because of your desk and your trading activities, interact with AIG? Or was it because your CDO group had been doing CDOs and AIG was taking the credit risk on the AAAs?
Well, thank you for the clarification. My group didn't do any trades with AIG. The CDO new issue group was selling many of their CDO new issue AAAs to AIG, so I was aware of that. It was also broadly known that they were the predominant buyer across the street. It wasn't that they were a secret Deutsche Bank account, and as we all know now, they have trades with lots of other people, so it wasn't just Deutsche Bank by any means. So I haven't done any trades with them that I remember, nothing. If I did any, it was a tiny, you know, tiny amount. Their primary involvement in the product was to buy AAA CDO tranches that had been created out of various underlying asset-backed securities. So they weren't somebody that I really knew at all, and they weren't a counterparty of mine.
And who was it that you talked to there?
Again, if I had ever imagined where things would go, I would have kept notes. But I remember.
Did you go to London for the meeting?
I mean, I spoke to a lot of different. I mean, what I'm trying to say is, I don't remember all the people that I spoke with because I didn't remember.
It wasn't just one.
Right. The name I remember because it's an unusual name is Tom Fewings, was one of the primary people that I spoke with. There was another person that I spoke with a lot. I didn't take notes. I don't remember the person's name. Because it was Smith or something that wasn't unusual. Probably wasn't Smith, but you know what I'm saying. So I spoke many times with people from AIG. I don't remember going to London. I went to London a lot. I don't remember speaking to AIG in London. So when I read the book, I thought that was a little weird. But I may have, because at the time, I know that what I remember distinctly is that I spent a lot of time speaking with AIG, sharing this book. And my group spent a lot of time doing analysis for them because at first they said, you know, when I called them up and I said, you're getting LIBOR plus 20 basis points and you might lose half your money. Like, this is I don't know if this is a smart thing to do and to do so much of. And I remember that they said that, you know, that I was crazy, you know, they're AAA and how could you possibly say that? So there was a lot of conversations. You know,
do you remember the general time frame?
Yeah, the first quarter of 2006.
Okay.
So, since I don't think I was sworn in, but since this is a place that we're certainly talking the truth, I don't remember specifically talking to AIG in London, but I may have. But I know that I spoke many times with them about this, is how I would want to answer that question.
And what was the response that they gave you when you presented this to them?
At first, you're crazy. These are AAA, super senior, and can't possibly be a problem. Later on, you know, but they, even though they led with that, they let me speak for an hour or two and kind of go through one version of this book. There became a certain amount of acceptance about perhaps I was, you know, there was some validity to what I was saying. So even though it was not likely that these would default, they began to maybe understand that the investment that they had wasn't actually one of likely versus unlikely, but rather, if the investment is profitable, earn a tiny amount of money, and if it's not profitable, we know what happened. So they may be, I believe that at some point they, I only know, I did a lot of calls with them, but from what I would understand, a lot of calls happened that I wasn't part of, that were between the people at AIG and the sales coverage at Deutsche Bank. So some of what I know was told to me by the salesman. So he may have filtered information. You know, I don't know. I know what he told me AIG told him, but that may not be what they told him. So at some point they accepted that this would be something to not do more of. So they stopped buying it. And I think that, like Mike Lewis says, I thought I saved the world all by myself or what have you. I think that's what he wrote. I thought that I had convinced AIG to stop buying these. And therefore, that would work out for me in the sense that the price of these securities would stop going up and would work out for everyone because people would stop buying them.
Did you ever have any knowledge of AIG's book of business and what percentage of it was made up of subprime?
No. It's not something that I would have studied because I didn't trade with them, so they weren't a counterparty. And even if I had traded with them, I didn't run the counterparty risk management group of Deutsche Bank. So it's not...
I mean, in response to this presentation, did they ever say, yeah, but most of our CDOs have a small percentage of subprime, so maybe you're right, but it doesn't significantly impact our business.
If they said that, I don't recall. I wasn't concerned about AIG as a counterparty because I weren't a counterparty of mine. And I was of the view that Deutsche Bank was appropriately hedging their counterparty exposure to AIG because there was a group that was supposed to do that, and that wasn't mine.
So you start marketing this to other institutional investors? What were the types of investors that you started marketing this to?
In the beginning, it was to anyone who would listen.
Well, this also started in the first quarter of 06, you said?
Yeah, first or second quarter of 06.
So who would listen?
Mostly hedge funds would listen, and mostly money managers and insurance companies would laugh at me and say I was crazy. And so they wouldn't listen.
How long did this process... I see a flipbook from January 06. I see one from June of 07. Was that roughly the period of time in which you were marketing these positions? Did it go on beyond?
Well, as a market maker, I mean, we always were marketing where people would ask. It may even have been, and I don't recall, it may even have been that we weren't marketing it anymore, but somebody would say, hey, I did this trade with you 6 months ago, and my boss wants to see an updated presentation. So we would update some of the slides. We'd update for home price changes or what have you. So we may not have been marketed in earnest anymore, but we were still updating the book upon request. I think also it's important to note that we got short in late 05, and by our most short we ever were was probably February 07. And then throughout 07, we were becoming less short. So even though this book was still being updated, we were actually reducing our short.
Why?
Well, we had made a significant amount of money, and the bank felt that, at least for my group, the group that I was running, which was the secondary trading group, we had been very short, and it might make sense to reduce some of our investments on the short side.
How big was the short position that you had in February of 07 at the height? Net.
You know, I don't entirely remember, and it's also difficult to know for sure because some of the things, like if you're long, just as an example, if you're long double Bs and you're short an equal amount of triple Bs, are you flat or are you long or are you short? So it's a simple thing to say, well, some of the business is easy to say, hey, we were short this much, but if we were long equity and short triple B as an example, well, how do you weight those two things? And, you know, obviously, as reported by Michael Lewis, this fellow at Morgan Stanley, he thought that he was short, and he was actually very long. So it's difficult to tell you how short we were, because because of that. But my estimate would be we were short somewhere between $5 and $10 billion, depending on how you define the different parts of the capital structure and whatnot.
And when you say you had made a lot of money and then you started reducing the short position, had you actually realized payouts on your positions? Or is this again?
Sure. Well, first of all, the defaults don't occur until later. So we had little to no actual pay-as-you-go CDS write-downs between, again, in our example before where I bought protection from you. You wouldn't have paid me anything. But if I sold protection to just Walter because he's sitting next to me, and so when we did our trade, it was 210, 200. In March of 06, it was now 175, 185. Now, in June of 07, it might have been 550, 525. So if I were able to do a trade with Walter where he bought protection from me at 550 on the same security that I bought protection from you on at 200, I made money. The reason I made money isn't because you've paid me anything, because you haven't, right? But now I'm getting 550 from him, and I'm paying 200 to you. So I would argue that we had made real money then. We made real money because we reduced our short position at a more favorable term than we had initiated our short position with again, in this example, you.
I've got to
take a break.
Call. Can we take a short?
Of course.
Yeah, I was hoping to get some more water.
Sure.